Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, from the highly anticipated film Fanboys, director Kyle Newman and actor Chris Marquette, plus an advanced peek at this Tuesday's DVD director's cut of David Fincher's Zodiac, complemented by an exclusive live interview with that film's screenwriter, Mr. James Vanderbilt. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Movie Geeks United is on the air, and we're so thrilled to bring you the show tonight. This is going to be a great one. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts, and Jerry is here with us, too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up, man? The chat room is just really hopping tonight. I mean, we have a lot of people in there right now.
Absolutely. If you're listening, log on to the chat room. You can converse back and forth with other fans, other movie fans, other fanboy fans, and there are a ton of them. We've received a ton of emails since we announced our guest tonight.
It's a big deal. I mean, this movie's been in development for a long time. I've read about this years ago, and I mean, this is a really big deal for us Star Wars fans. So absolutely.
And we couldn't be more thrilled about tonight's show. It's going to be a great show. So Jerry will be manning the chat rooms tonight. And I was just thinking, you know, listening to that opening music, we've had so many great film composers on the show. Howard Shore, Mark Isham, John Ottman.
I hope they sue you for comparing our theme music.
That's just what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Get one of those genius people to write us a theme. It sounds like 70s porn music. It really
does.
I want
Johnny Greenwood to write our theme music. The guy.
I tell you what, there will be blood.
Yeah,
man,
I want
score.
Him to write our theme music.
Yeah. For those of you listening in, this is Movie Geeks United, and if you have a passion for movies, this is the show for you. We encourage you to look through our archive of past shows if you're just joining us for the first time. We have great topics, great guests, everyone from Brian De Palma to the owner of Pink's Hot Dogs. I mean, like, all over the map, just great content, really. And out of those two, Pink's Hot Dogs guy, he was surprisingly polarizing.
I think I'm just amazed that the plumbing in Los Angeles still works after some of them.
Jerry, why'd you have to go there?
I had to because my mind's always in the gutter. But before, can I just make an announcement, though?
Sure.
Our just a couple of public service announcements, and I'm going to let you get on the way. But our friend
yes.
Tony DeFrancisco this week launched a new site, filmarcade.net.
Yes.
And you can, there, I have a link on one of the blogs to them, but everyone should add them as a friend on MySpace and go visit them. I believe it's a Blogspot account where people, you know, a lot of our favorite writers will be writing for them. And another friend of mine, Chris, has a site, Quell Horror,
okay,
that I have a link on yesterday's blog announcing all the shows today. There's a link for that, and I hope everyone will add them as a friend. And also, last but not least, me and Kelsey are going to be on Horror Movie Fans later tonight at 10 o'clock on Blog Talk Radio.
That's right. You guys are talking about the best of the year,
right? The best horror films from horroryearbook.com.
Is there two titles to choose from, or is it better than that?
Oh, it's like 5,000 titles to choose from.
Okay.
No, we'll be on, I think, around 10:30.
Okay.
On, but you should listen to the whole thing because they have Brandon Slagle on at 10 o'clock, I think, and that should be good. And they, you know, we love their interviews. They're very down-to-earth, and they're great guys. And,
terrific. Yeah. I will be listening.
Okay.
Count me in.
All right, cool.
Also, we need to announce real quick, and then we'll get right to it. Wednesday night show, we have the director of the new documentary called Oswald's Ghost. If you've read reviews of this, it's getting A's, like, across the board. His name is Robert Stone, no relation to Oliver, surprisingly enough.
I always thought that was the writer, too. I didn't realize they're two different people for the longest time.
Yeah, and then Friday, this is what's great about our show. Sunday, we welcome John Sayles, last Sunday. This Friday, we welcome Dolph Lundgren. That's Movie Geek Heaven right there.
Showdown in Little Tokyo. That's what it's all about.
I know. I feel the same way. Okay, in case you haven't noticed, it is now cool to be a geek. In fact, the so-called geeks and fanboys wield an unprecedented influence over the entertainment industry. Of course, they've always been an instrumental force in the industry, even though it seems that Hollywood has only just started to take notice. But for evidence of the fanboys' passion and enthusiasm, look no further than the Star Wars series, particularly those crazed years and months leading up to the release of the long-awaited Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. Those fans and that eagerly anticipated fantasy epic are the basis of a new film opening soon across the country, a smashingly entertaining and hysterical work that promises to be the ultimate film for the fanboy generation. In the appropriately titled film Fanboys, a group of diehard Star Wars fans concoct a scheme to break into Skywalker Ranch and view an advanced screening of The Phantom Menace to fulfill the wish of a dying friend. This long-awaited film has received unrivaled buzz and features great cast that includes Kristen Bell, Dan Fogler, Seth Rogen, Danny Trejo, William Shatner, and Chris Marquette. And we are welcomed, or we are honored tonight to welcome Chris Marquette to our program. He is an exceptional actor whose previous credits include terrific work in television series like Huff, Strong Medicine, and Joan of Arcadia, and films like Alpha Dog, The Girl Next Door, Freddy vs. Jason, American Gun, The Invisible, and Just Friends, for which he was nominated for both an MTV and a Teen Choice Award. Also joining us is the director of Fanboys, Mr. Kyle Newman, a multi-talented writer, actor, editor, producer, and director whose previous credits include the feature film titled The Hollow. It is a great honor to welcome both of these tremendous talents to our show, Mr. Newman and Mr. Marquette. Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Hi. Oh, you guys can hear me. Hi.
You guys loud and clear. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. We're
Thank
very
you.
Excited.
Of course, man. Oh, of course. That was a very grand entrance. I don't know. Oh, that's crazy. How you guys doing?
We're doing great. And like we said, man, we've been flooded with emails since we announced your appearance on the show. And the most common question I get from everyone, please make sure you get out of them, when are we going to be able to see this film?
Yeah.
That's my common question, too, of my life right now. It changes from day to day, but I think I'd say March or April, they're telling me now. We went back in and did some more reshoots and changed the movie around a little bit. So I think they're expecting it all to be done this next month, I think before February, so that they can release it in March or April.
So the January 18th date that we've seen is incorrect.
Yes, it's definitely incorrect. As of what I know, like this week. I mean, maybe next week it changes, but right now I'd say 99% it's not going to come out January 18th. So the
Weinstein Company, they have the film. They're releasing it, correct?
Yeah, they're releasing. Holding on to it, they wanted to add, I think some things in, and fortunately and unfortunately, everybody in the movie has been working a lot, so it was really difficult to get us all together to get the whole cast back together to reshoot some things. It took a really long time to do that, and we finally got that done late this last year. So they've been editing it together, and I just went and saw a little part of it about a week ago.
So tell me, Kyle, about the history of this project and why it's taken so long, how you came on board, the whole story leading up to now. You have 5 seconds. Go ahead.
5 seconds. I read about this thing online back in 1998.
That's right. News. So, yeah.
That's how I found out about it. I was going through, different internet sites trying to find out what I could about Star Wars, and I ended up coming across this project called Fanboy. And one of the producers who we got introduced to many years later, he had spent a year tracking on the project when he heard it never got made because he was just a fan of the idea of the script. He wanted to see what it was. And then about 4.5 years ago, he brought me on board, and we met, and a mutual friend was like, "You have to meet Kyle. He's the biggest Star Wars fan." And then he's like, "You got to meet Matt, who's the producer, and he's got this script about Star Wars fans." I was like, "All right, I'm game. I'll read this." And it turned out it was Fanboys. And I was like, "Wait, you have that script?" And he's like, "Yeah, it never got made, and do you want to do it?" So basically, it led to a love fest of just us. We had to rework the script a bit, and we just gradually added on
you know, people to the team, just passionate
yeah.
Star Wars fans. Our Adam Goldberg came on to do the final production draft, who's a great writer. I know he just did work on the Jetsons, and he's done a bunch of movies recently. And, you know, and then also bringing on all the actors, it was, like, the most fun. And at first, we were going to make it independently, and we were putting our money together that way. And then at the
right.
Moment, Weinstein Company came in and, you know, got behind it and let us, you know, shoot the script as it was, as a negative pickup. So, but you know,
where does Kevin Spacey's Trigger Street company come in?
Kevin Spacey came in before the Weinstein Company got involved, and they had read the script. We had gone out with it to a few places, and you know, Kevin Spacey's actually a big Star Wars fan, so he read it and fell in love with it and wanted to see the thing get made, because, you know, it's not a traditional comedy. It's not the movie made. We wanted to make something that's dramatic, but still had, you know, comedic elements. And there was a lot going on in the script, which is why I think so many people and actors were attracted to it.
Yeah.
Why we could get the great cast we did. And I remember I knew I wanted Chris in the movie. There was like two roles, and I was like, I got to have him as one of these two.
Yeah.
And I was like, kind of, I was talking to him like, well, which one? He actually read for both. I just knew he had
yeah.
the movie, because he's one of the few people, I think, in his generation that can be absolutely hysterical but so emotionally grounded. And
that's absolutely
you know,
right.
Right.
Yeah. So Chris, what attracted you to the script when you read it?
I think it's really charming. I mean, it's a very, you know, not a lot of movies can get away with all of the things this movie gets away with and still be, you know, reasonably believable. And like, you know, it's a sort of a trick of the 80s, I feel like, that they, you know, a few people found that niche of like, you know, being able to throw in some really crazy ideas to a very honest story and get away with it and have people like actually go in and believe it and enjoy it and be, you know, somewhat emotionally committed to it. And you know, there's tons and tons of teen scripts nowadays and movies about a bunch of teenagers doing something, and usually they all fall flat on their face. And this one, immediately, as soon as I read it, really didn't. It really stood out amongst you know, so many pieces of crap, to be honest. And this was like so, and this was like so nice and refreshing. And, you know, and when I went in, I met with Kyle and I met with, you know, Matt and Kevin, and, the two other producers, and they seemed awesome. And they seemed like guys who like really cared about this movie, like so much. And they really just wanted to like, you know, have a fun time making a movie, which is at the end of the day, you know, it's what I've sort of signed my life up for, you know?
Right.
So it was nice. So you walk in a room, there's these great young guys, everybody wants to make a great movie. They told me about Jay Baruchel and Dan Fogler and Kristen Bell at that point, and then you know, I was like, wow, well, that sounds, you know, so the rest of the cast is awesome. And you know, and then Kyle was like, I'm not sure which part, you know, I want you to play or which part you think you should play. It's like, but let's just, you know, let's read a couple different ones. So I read for the part I eventually played and Sam Huntington's part, and you know, we just went back and forth, and you know, and eventually, I'm really glad I played the part I did. I really fell in love with that one more than anything. So,
well,
yeah, that's it. Then we went out to New Mexico and filmed it. So.
The movie seems like it has incredible heart, you know.
Yeah.
And you're talking about these cast members, but you also have really kind of iconic members of the cast. Like
I know.
William Shatner and people
yeah.
actually within the Star
Gary
Wars.
Fisher.
Yeah, Carrie Fisher, Billy Dee Williams. I mean, yeah, they're, yeah, there's, I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, it's really nice. I mean, you know, I think with the group of people that were backing this and being like really, you know, full force, like trying to show people how exciting of a project this is, I think that, you know, when it made the rounds to different people, I'm sure Kyle could tell you more about it, like who they went to and things like that. You know, it's like, you know, I feel like they always got a really good response, and, you know, that's why we got those really cool people to be in the movie, so.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
because people would read the script and then love it, and they'd be like, well, what about the Lucasfilm factor, or how are you going to get these cameos? So it's really like, get one thing, and then you have to use it to help get the next thing.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Really, and you're making the movie for, we made it for $4 million, so it's not like you can throw money at people.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Excuse me. You have to cut a lot of corners when you make a movie at $4 million. And
right,
the
right.
The script was really... should have made it twice that cost. There were so many scenes where things that we were looking forward to shooting, which we just never could do. So it's like you're cutting it the week before, you're cutting it the day before. And to my frustration, probably to the actor's frustration, but I think ultimately when you if something's still working and the story still works and the heart's still there, I look at it now, I don't miss the things I didn't film. But at the
right.
time, you know, there's the struggles of making a movie that scale and then getting a big corporation like Lucasfilm behind it.
Well, that's just it. You did get cooperation from...
How did you do that?
Yeah.
You know, I think they read the material, and there was a couple things that were like stormtroopers and shouldn't be drinking alcohol. So there's certain things that, like, if you change a thing, then we're cool. You know, stormtroopers aren't going to be doing drugs, so you can't
right, right.
do that in the movie. So there were guidelines, but I think they realized that the ultimate the movie was just, you know, it was a love letter to Star Wars. It was super positive.
Absolutely.
Anything negative towards the prequels, and there's a couple of jokes in there, but it takes place in that time before the prequels. So they're going into it with that innocence, so they don't know what the movie's going to be like. They're just excited about it.
But you still use the Jedi mind trick to remove a girl's clothes, right? Is that still in there?
That's still in there, and that's okay with some people up there. So,
I think overall, we
kept pushing to see how much we could get from them, and ultimately we even got Ewoks humping people. So,
I love it. I love
you can get away with a lot if they trust you. And
so here's the big question, guys. Before we get to the load of questions we have from your fans, your personal take on the Phantom Menace. I think that obviously. The build-up kind of, it couldn't help it. It transcended whatever the final product would be. We just wanted to kind of return to our childhood in a way.
Absolutely.
With
yeah.
Phantom Menace. But what was your take on the Phantom Menace? Either one. Let's
yeah,
start with
yeah.
you, Chris.
Okay. I personally was really let down. I really wish that they hadn't abused so much CGI, to be completely honest, and
right.
you know, I kind of felt like after a while it was, you know, it was also that time in special effects where computer technology, like computer games and video games, were getting so kind of real looking and stuff that it was almost looking like it was going to surpass movies,
right.
you know, like the special effects that you see in that, and so, you know, it wasn't. At the time, it wasn't, in my opinion, significantly better than, like, some video games I could play on my computer, to be
true,
really honest.
True.
Like, it wasn't like it is now, you know, where, like, I mean, you know, I've played some games that are just ridiculous, and they look so unbelievably real, and they scare the crap out of me sometimes, but, you know, there's, like, you know, the movies have gone so above and beyond what anybody thought was possible that, like, now it's, you know, you can't compare the two, but at the time... I felt like you really could, and so unfortunately, watching the whole movie, I was like, yeah, I mean, really impressive, really great ideas, but, like, visually, I just wasn't as, you know, sort of amazed as what I thought it would be, you know? Like, I really thought it was going to, you know, sort of, my eyes were going to pop out of their sockets, and
I think we all
did. I enjoyed it. Yeah, you know, and I think I enjoyed it. I mean, I definitely remember, you know, definitely enjoying it. I just, you know, I think it's the same thing that most people felt, which is this is kind of like, okay. It was all right.
But it
was almost it. Say again?
There's certain things I watch, and I'm like, why did he put that in? Or I cringe. But overall, I still enjoyed it. I love the pod race. And
That's the highlight.
Lightsaber fight.
Yeah.
And I liked like we were talking about, the experience, the build-up. And
mm-hmm.
That was fun.
No part of it. And that's something I wouldn't give away. Cause that was
that's
so
just, that's
fun.
Just it. And I think it's I think
so many things.
I think it's probably something that your film touches on. There's just something, in the like months leading up to that film, there's just something so pure about people wanting to return to that place. You know,
that's the key to our movie. I mean, ultimately for me, it was like, I know that's such a divided issue with people. Some people hate it. Some people love it. I've seen it probably like 25 times, and the more
I think me and you both.
But I get into arguments with people all the time about the prequels. But I think that's the key to our movie is that it's not about the movie. It's about what you remember,
mm-hmm.
experience building up towards it, and it's that relationship you have with people that also are fans. So ultimately, I just wanted to not avoid the movie, but it takes place in that time beforehand, so it's almost doesn't
right,
matter
right.
what the movie is. What matters is that they all love Star Wars.
Yeah, the experience.
And that's the thing about Star Wars, too. Where the fans have taken it into their hearts for the past 30 years and really... made it their own. I mean, they've elevated it to the status that it is now. But let's get to a couple of these questions. First of all, Ann, Deb, and Tina from chrismarquette.com say hello.
Hi. Hello.
and this one comes from Tina in Germany. She wants to know about the reshoots and how they kind of built upon the original storyline. Can either of you speak to that?
Well, too much. I can't talk about it too much, but there was a couple of things that were shot that you know, we're kind of experimenting with. So I don't know what's going to stick. And there's a couple things that were shot. There were things that for a long time I knew that the movie needed and we wanted to do to mm-hmm. open it up or to like one or two bigger set pieces. So I mean that's why it's not coming out till spring. Now we finally got to shoot stuff. There's going to be some time to figure out what we're going to put in. And obviously the studio has a slightly different perspective than I do. So
yeah. Yeah. This one comes from Laura in Pennsylvania. This one's for you, Chris. Did you keep any prop or piece of wardrobe from the film?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? I own one whole uniform. I mean, I have a great G.I. Joe shirt and these, like, awesome Nike boots that Nike gave to us. And I was like, all right, I'll keep these in, like, jeans. So I have one whole outfit. Sort of if I can like make a Planet Hollywood out of my living room, I guess I can put a mannequin in and, you know, and have myself staring at me in the corner. So, but that's, yeah, I got that. And then we all got like some free Star Wars stuff. I mean, I got a free lightsaber, which was awesome, which I still have on my mantle piece in my living room. I think everybody has the exact same thing, and not only have they like just kept it, but everybody's put it up. I know Kyle has, I know Jay has. And I think Sam Huntington did also, and Kevin and Matt did too. So yeah, all of us. But that. Oh yeah. Christian's got yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the Star Wars community. I mean, I know that it must be a very close knit universe of fans. But how welcoming have they been to you when you've traveled to promote this film at different conferences and things?
They've been awesome.
Yeah, they're always awesome.
Actually,
I mean,
the only person that got to go shoot up at the ranch, you know, itself, the real ranch. So
yeah.
Oh, what was that like? I mean, what is that?
Oh, amazing. It was incredible. I was trying to sneak around to different places. So we found like this cool. They have like this nursery garden with these huge plants that, like, I mean, I don't know what he grows in there, but I imagine there's some freaky plants that he's got from all over the world. But that was really awesome. Then they've got this great, amazing editing room like downstairs that I got to snag like a quick look at. And just like sort of the entrance before this security guard was like, oh, excuse me. I was like, okay, I'm sorry, I'm working. And like walked away. But it was really, I mean, oh my God, it was incredible. I mean, that guy, I mean, George Lucas, I don't know where he comes from, but like he created this entire, you know, way back in this mountain landscape, like this huge house that exists back there where like he makes his movies. Like it's like a comic book in itself, I think, like that whole,
his
lifestyle there.
It's like he's created a whole different universe for himself and, you know, in real life, on screen and in real life.
Yeah, I mean, it cultivates his ideas and what he does in his movies. I mean, it really does. It has to, you know, it's not like he's going to like the Sony lot or the Paramount Studios and being like, yeah, I'll sit in this office over here. And, you know, it's like he actually was like, no, I'm going to put some wild animals around my place. I'm going to make a bedroom for actors and editors to stay in. That's going to be the Akira Kurosawa room with like every, you know, like all these relics from Akira Kurosawa's movies. Like it's unbelievable. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
We had Rick McCallum decided, you know, he was a fan of the script. He wanted to come out and just hang out while we were shooting. So he just spent the night there, just chilling.
That's no pressure whatsoever. this comes from Dory in Canada. At Star Wars Celebration 4, you gave out comic books that were prequels to fanboys. She liked the comic book a great deal, and she wants to know how thrilled you were, Chris, to see yourself as a comic book character.
Oh my God! Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's the coolest thing that has ever happened to me. Actually, it's really weird because I showed my mother the comic book, and you know, my mom. I grew up in New Jersey, working in New York as a kid, and I was like a child actor, and we would go in through the Port Authority every day, and every time a new issue of any comic book I'd been reading was there, she would sit down with me, and she was able to like read a little bit, and you know, and I'd, you know, we'd sit in this like long bus line for like an hour and just read comic books, and she's like, did you ever think when you were younger that now you would be on the cover? I was like, no, Mom, I would never would have. And it really brought me exactly back to some, you know, crazy sense of like, you know, God knows, you know, what's in store for you, I guess, when, you know, I would have never, ever guessed that in a million years that was all possible for me. So it was awesome. It's really a great feeling.
So have you guys had a chance to screen? I know it's still in post, but have you screened any kind of version of the film to fans to get their reaction?
I screened it. We screened about 40 minutes at the Star Wars Celebration in the U.S. I screened the entire movie at Star Wars Celebration Europe, and that was unbelievable. I think there was 1,800 people there
in
the room, and I was like, I for the first time, I got nervous before I was showing it. I was like, oh my God, this is the real deal. It's not a test screening. This is my audience, and a lot of them. And at the end of it, you know, we got 3 standing ovations. I was like,
ugh.
I was shocked. I was like, oh, my God. It was like 8-9 minutes of people clapping and people on their chairs with lightsabers, and I videotaped it, and I sent it to the studio. I was like, see? I don't like my version. But that was probably the best and biggest experience we've had showing.
Oh, that must have been great.
Yeah.
So the film opens in March or April. So where can we keep an eye out for definitive date?
I don't know, to be honest.
Here the official date, but it's spring, and you know it's a studio that's known for moving their movies a lot. As you know, it's been moved 6 times, and it's hard. Like, my philosophy is, when you're releasing a movie, you pick a date, you commit to it, you own it,
sure,
and you scare people away. And if you start moving your movie, and it's a small movie, but you know, they have aspirations to release it like a larger comedy. So, I don't know. I think spring is a good time to do it, looking for like a spring break kind of weekend, and that's what they're going to try to go with.
Well, I think whenever you release it, the fans are definitely going to follow. I mean, your core group, who you made the movie for, they're going to catch it whenever it's available to them, and I'm sure they're going to eat it up.
I mean, that's the group I care about. I made it
for
– there's something in it for everybody. And in all age groups, but ultimately, it's so close to my life and how it means to me. So I want it to like play for the people that, you know, that are the fans, because it's so personal to me. Even though it's not my story or anything, it's just, you know, I really felt like, and we all bonded making the movie. I just thought it was something very unique. So I hope it plays to those people, you know, the diehard fans and even the casual fans. You know.
So beyond fanboys, what's ahead for you both?
You go ahead, Kyle.
The strike has kind of really hurt things for me.
Yeah.
It really slowed things down. So I'm developing this Wolfman Jack biopic.
Wow.
Which is,
that'll be great.
Really cool. It's like, you know, it's his legend as like he would tell it. It evolves into something a little bit larger than life, like an adaptation kind of thing. And then I'm working on a project with the guys that produced Enchanted and wrote Enchanted. So that might be something I shoot this year.
That's great.
The comedy. Other than that, it's just developing a lot of projects, and you know, the Car Wars, that role playing game from the 80s.
Actual
role playing game. So we're developing that into like a Blade Runner science fiction thing.
Wow, you got some exciting things on your plate. How about you?
Yeah, man, that last one sounds awesome, Kyle. Again, the strike sort of affected. I was supposed to go to Thailand to do a war movie called Pinkville late last
Oliver
year.
Oliver Stone.
And unfortunately, with the strike, and it's created a bunch of problems, and one of the actors dropped out, and that created more problems, and so they're pushing that off until at some point, you know, undisclosed this year. So. So that seems like the next step, you know, for me right now. And I finished a film this last year called Infestation, which is this kind of cool sci-fi action comedy about
is
bugs
that,
taking over the world. And
is that thing. Kyle Efram and?
Kyle Rankin and Efron was his old directing partner who directed the special effects in the movie and not the movie itself, and it was just Kyle Rankin directing. But it was really cool. We went to Bulgaria and shot for like 2.5 months, and it was the first, like, you know, I've done some movies with special effects, but like this movie was like me fighting with fake bugs that are like, you know, it's really just like a giant man in a green suit, you know. It's like really weird, but it was really awesome. It was like the, you know, sort of a, you know, sort of a childhood dream of mine too. So it was really cool. And so that should be out, you know, I think either late this year or early the following year, 2009.
And as an official Oliver Stone geek, I mean, just let me say, I hope Pinkville gets back on track after this writer's strike.
Me too.
That's a great project right there for him.
Yeah, no, I think it is too, and I think it definitely will. I mean, I've talked to him, and he had said that, you know, for sure, he's like, you know, I don't want anybody to lose faith because this, you know, it falling apart last minute is not the end of it by any means. And so, I think it's good. And I mean, if it's anybody, I think in the business that could have a movie fall apart and completely take it back up on its feet, I think it's a guy like him. So
he is tenacious. Yeah.
To say the least, and yeah.
But thank you both so much.
Yes, thank you
for joining us tonight.
I'm glad, guys.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you both, and you both are welcome back on anytime you'd like.
Thank you so much for having us.
Cool. Thank you very much. Good luck.
All right.
Thanks,
guys.
Thank you, guys. Goodbye.
Okay.
That is director Kyle Newman and co-star Chris Marquette from the upcoming film Fanboys. That's one that it's going to be huge.
I think it's going to be pretty big. I can't wait to see it. It's like he brought up a good point. You know, we went to go back and see the first one, even the second one, a couple of times because they're like, all right, let's see what's going on here. Is there a lot to look at? He's very honest. It is a letdown, the first one, even the second one, but the third one, I felt he got everything back on track. But
he got most everything back on track, man.
But it was fun. I think they capture the build up very well.
But if you look at the original trilogy, which, you know, anyone that knows anything about Star Wars, basically they know everything about Star Wars. So this isn't any surprising information. But you look at the screenwriters he handed off some of the other installments to.
Oh yeah, Lawrence Kasdan.
Lawrence Kasdan, a great writer.
Yeah.
I think Empire is the strongest of the Star Wars.
Oh, Empire is not just the strongest; it's the best film. I mean, it works as a standalone film, but it's just perfect. There's nothing wrong with that film. It is just perfect in every sense of the word.
Yeah. So, and part of it was the.
You have a fan, by the way, in a chat room. Eric G just called you a freaking genius. So I think you should, you know, I'm not going to use any foul language. You know,
we love Eric G on the show, and we've paid him handsomely to say things like that.
Really? Okay, I want that paycheck
exactly.
too,
and not all in cash. But this movie is going to just it's going to be a phenomenon. I really do think so, and I think no matter when you release it, it's one of those movies where just release it. I think that you're good whenever you release it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely.
But they do get kind of skittish about release dates.
I think they're scared. I mean, I wouldn't go up against Indiana Jones 4.
Right.
I wouldn't go up against that or Iron Man, but I wouldn't release it against, I guess they got spooked because of Cloverfield, because that was January 18th.
Yeah.
But I would have released it sometime in February, or I would have released it next week, actually, but...
Yeah, I understand the whole concept of counter-programming. Yeah. When you're talking about Cloverfield,
I wouldn't
even though it's a lot more limited in scope,
yeah.
you're basically going after a similar audience.
Yeah.
And definitely with Indiana Jones. So how's the chat room looking? Lively?
The chat room's alive. We got all our friends are in there. It's just crazy.
Great. Hope everyone's enjoying the show so far. It ain't over yet. Let's bring in real quick. We have our guest on hold, and let's bring in our home entertainment guru, Mr. Aaron Ottadias, for this next segment. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, fellas, what's up?
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm excited.
We are excited about this because, you know, one of the great movies in 2007, you and I are in total agreement that this is the first great DVD of 2008.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, without a doubt. So this is going to be big for us. We've been very vocal about this on our show. In a great year for movies, David Fincher's Zodiac rests on all of our top-of-the-year lists. This meticulously crafted thriller about obsession and the need to know the unknowable plays out like a great novel filled with rich characters and engrossing multiple storylines. On Tuesday, the film receives the DVD treatment it so richly deserves, and a special 2-DVD director's cut featuring a plethora of enlightening extra features, including a commentary from the film's screenwriter, James Vanderbilt. With Zodiac, Mr. Vanderbilt has flawlessly crafted one of cinema's great screenplays. His resume is filled with additional outstanding work, including Darkness Falls, Basic, and The Rundown. We are truly honored to welcome this extraordinary screenwriter, Mr. James Vanderbilt, to our program. Mr. Vanderbilt, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. So great now that you've agreed to do the show. We're wonderful.
My pleasure. It's the first time I've ever heard anyone describe Basic or Darkness Falls as outstanding, so I that alone. I'm so excited.
Well, the check cleared.
Tell me, Zodiac, we are crazy about this film. We've been campaigning for the film all year. This was a real dream project for you, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It was something I'd read Robert Gray Smith's first book when I was 15 in high school and just kind of got really sort of sucked into it. And when I got out to Los Angeles and started actually getting work, I sort of went, inquired about the rights to it, and found out that Disney actually owned the rights already, which made, of course, a lot of sense to me. But figured that was that, and I was never going to get to take a shot at it. And then a few years later, I was finishing up working on Basic with Brad Fisher, who's a producer of Phoenix Pictures, and he sort of said, if you could do anything, in the world, what would it be? And I told him about the book, and I sent him the book, and I said, but there's, there's no possible, way we'll get to do it because the rights are already sold. And he looked into it, and apparently by that time, Disney had sort of realized that they were, Disney and not going to make the movie and let the rights lapse. And so that's sort of how we got into it. But, about half my life I've been interested in doing this.
When you read it, obviously it's a great murder mystery, it's a great detective story, but thematically, what about it spoke to you?
I think that, when I first read it, when I was 15 years old, I just sort of got off on the idea of this sort of this true life mystery. But then over the years, I think it was a couple different things. I think the idea of obsession is, pretty hardcore in the film, but I also I like the idea of Robert Gray Smith is such a fun, wacky dude when you actually meet him that came through. It doesn't come through as much in the book as it does when you actually sort of sit down with him and we put him in that. But there was something sort of really interesting about Zodiac is almost this kind of postmodern figure. It was interesting because I was a writer who's writing about a writer, Robert Gray Smith,
sure,
who's kind of after this killer who's really more famous for writing all of these letters. I mean, when it comes to actual body count and doing horrible things, Zodiac's really, pretty minor. It's more how he marketed himself.
That's right. Yeah.
And using the press. And so that kind of really fascinated me. There's, he becomes, he made himself famous through more of his writing than his actual horrible deeds.
Well, I think that the movie is obviously it has comparisons to some of our great films. I mean, I see elements of All the President's Men and everything to JFK even in it. But did you use any films as kind of role models in your writing process?
I didn't. This one was really sort of an odd duck because I mean I'm a huge fan of All the President's Men and a huge fan of JFK and I think as a writer there's no way to sort of you can escape your influences only so much in terms of what's the stuff, William Goldman's one of those guys who made me want to be a writer. So,
yeah.
And Oliver Stone's one of those directors who, but we also, it was interesting during the whole process, we talked a lot about, we talked about both of those films and we also, talked a lot about JFK and not wanting to be JFK because JFK, and it is one of my favorite films, but it very much operates from the idea of this film exists to convince you, the viewer, of a particular premise.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to do exactly the opposite of that. We wanted to give you all of these sort of information, but we don't have a particular axe to grind in terms of convincing you that Arthur Lee Allen is the Zodiac. And so it was sort of, that doesn't mean that the characters that whose story we're telling don't believe that. But we wanted to make sure that the film itself isn't trying to sell you a particular product in that way.
I see the JFK comparison in that the obsession with knowing the unknowable and how it takes over your life. And with All the President's Men, and this is the thing that I enjoyed so much about that film and particularly Zodiac, the excitement and the drama in seeing people working. I mean, oftentimes doing the most mundane kind of activities.
I'm a big fan of process movies. I sort of love getting caught up in the, I mean, well, pretty clearly the minutia of stuff. But you know how you know sort of and you know, which is great about Fincher. Fincher loves that stuff too. And so, you know, I'm sort of fascinated with those scenes where you have to sit down. There's a great scene that we got to put back in for the director's cut, where Toski and Armstrong, Mark Ruffalo and Anthony Edwards are sort of going through. They're going through all of the evidence they've sort of collected in order to get a search warrant for Arthur Lee Allen. And it's about a 3.5-minute scene of them sort of laying out their case. But what's sort of fascinating to me about it, and why we put it in the movie, is you've never really seen how much work cops have to go through to get a search warrant before.
Yeah.
You know? And it's so I don't know, I'm sort of obsessed with that kind of that process thing as well. And
it,
also
it was,
what it's, you know, what it's like to work at a city paper, you know, and that stuff in All the President's Men. So
it,
I think
it's not like Law and Order where they say get a warrant and then next scene it's like, you know, they've gotten a warrant and things have already been
absolutely,
done.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's funny because, I mean, you know, I remember, I don't know how old you guys are, but when Law and Order first started,
Everybody
was like, oh, wow, Law and Order is so amazing because it really shows you what the process is compared to what's come before, you know. And even that, you know, you only got an hour to tell it, so it glosses. I mean.
But it took them a year to get a search warrant, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me when David Fincher came on board. He was obviously a first choice. I mean, this is the go-to guy for this kind of movie. How thrilling was that when he said, yeah, this is something that I want to do?
It was really great. I mean, it sort of came about in stages. I mean, the you know, obviously we sort of sent it to him first because it's, you know, if you do anything remote, we sort of assumed we have to show it to him. It's like asking the prettiest girl to prom, basically. You know, she's going to say no, and then you can go about the actual work of finding a date. And so when he was like, no, I'd actually like to sit down, you know, I was kind of rocked back on my heels by that. And, you know, he was very, he grew up actually in Marin County, which we didn't know when we sent it to him. So he had a bit of a personal connection to the material and remembered when all this was kind of happening. He was about, you know, 8 or 9. So it's one of his sort of first memories. So I think we really got lucky just in terms of the subject matter. And but he was very sort of vocal about the fact that he, you know, he's like, listen, I have no interest in making a serial killer. I've made my serial killer movie.
Sure.
You know, I'm really interested in making, you know, a newspaper film.
Yeah.
And which we, you know, I mean, we had a lot of elements of that already in the film, but we were sort of very excited about, you know, that we weren't going to get someone who was going to be really excited to do sort of the very prurient, you know, version of this.
So is that how the script kind of transformed once he came on board? It was a more meticulous look at the paper business and the police procedural aspect of it, or?
It was. What's interesting is actually I think, you know, God, I haven't looked at the very first draft in so long. From my recollection, the script was more actually about, the very first draft had more Graysmith in it. And Toski wasn't as much of a character, and it's interesting because it actually sort of ended up going the opposite way. The police stuff actually expanded with David in it, but more of that process stuff, which I was sort of really excited. It was interesting because, you know, for instance, in the film there's the whole sort of section with Melvin Belli and the Zodiac Caller and all that, and that was in my original first draft, and I had cut it out to kind of get the length down, because this is always we'd always have a problem with length on the film, and I'm actually really happy with it, but it was always, you know, from the very beginning it's, we got to get it shorter and shorter and shorter. And so I took out this Melvin Belli section, and David read the movie and came onto the movie and was developing it, and one day I sort of said, you know, there's this thing I cut out that was kind of interesting, and I've got about 20 seconds into describing it, and he goes, oh, you got to put it back in.
Yeah.
So it's always, you know, it was getting that stuff in that doesn't necessarily impact, because in reality, narratively, that scene goes nowhere. There's not a real Zodiac on the other end of the line. They don't learn anything about the case. So, you know, from your sort of very typical studio textbook narrative standpoint, you get nothing out of that sequence other than it's interesting and that happened. But for sort of process junkies and, you know, guys who are excited about seeing, you know, how this case affected the San Francisco area and how,
right,
you know, it got blown up by the media, it's great stuff. So,
oh, it's adds a great flavor to the film.
Yeah,
particularly the way Brian Cox plays it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, he was fabulous. But
oh,
know,
terrific.
That stuff, he's, you know, and then he was the other thing that you know, David did sort of during the process of reworking the script, and we did draft after draft after draft, but was really keep us honest on the research part of it. And
yeah,
you know, we sat down with, over sort of the course of 18 months, as many people as we could who were still, you know, with us, and cops and you know, both the surviving victims and
I definitely want to ask you about those. Aaron, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm a little technical thing. I mean, on the Melvin Belli thing, I just want to say the one thing that it teaches us, and it teaches the audience and the cops, is that they're going to get a lot of cranks coming out of the woodwork, is really what that scene illustrates. But what I'm curious about is, I know Robert Graysmith wrote two books on Zodiac, so I'm curious on the screenwriting process, was this a matter of synthesizing both books? And I know one of the books, Robert is very kind of just laying out all the facts, and then I think in the other book, he starts interjecting himself into the narrative. So I was wondering, was it a matter of synthesizing his two books into the script, or did you lean?
It did. It ended up sort of being that he doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't. In the first book, he really. It's much more of a this happened and this happened and this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the second book, he puts himself more into it. But he also, the second book is also, you know, written from the point of view is, the second book's called Zodiac Unmasked. So
right,
sort of right off the top, you figure he's gonna finger the guy he thinks is in. And so the second book's much more about the sort of history of Arthur Lee Allen and investigating that. And so there was an amalgam to it, but I mean, I would say, you know, 70 to 80% of the movie came out of the first book.
Is there, is there one incident, or because both of these books, I mean, they have such great detail and stories that you don't, like the, you know, Melvin Belli and the killings and so forth. Was there one little incident from either one of these books that you wanted to put in, but, you know, time, you know, finally had to get cut? I mean, because you said, you know, it was always a matter of cutting down and scenes were being taken out and putting in, but was there one thing?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, there were tons of things. There was, you know, some of the stuff at Lake Berryessa after, you know, Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shevel were stabbed. Brian actually managed to sort of, you know, chew off some of his ropes and try and go for help and made it about 50 feet. But I mean, sort of this Herculean effort to sort of save her. But it would have been, you know, the scene wouldn't have ended right. I mean, there's, you know, I don't know. There's like a ton of different stuff. There's a ton of stuff about sort of Paul Avery. There's a great amount of stuff. I feel like we never got there was something really cool about the fact that Son of Sam was going on in New York by the
That's
time
right.
Robert had kind of come around to researching the Yellow Book. And we sort of get into the third, you know, the last third of the movie where Graysmith really kind of takes the reins. The airwaves were actually dominated by all the Son of Sam things. So there was, I don't know,
Manson was
lot,
about the
yeah.
Manson was about the same time, 68, 69, or...
Oh, absolutely.
Was, yeah.
And there were a lot of just Zodiac theories that we never... I mean, you know, there were, you know, a lot of letters we couldn't sort of read. There's a sort of dearth of material. He sent maps and clues with radians and that we could never... It just never really, you know, got in there. There was stuff that we made sure was in there that you know, normally, like I said, the Melvin Belli stuff, I think, in the sort of a... In a different movie, that never would have made it in. The Kathleen John stuff with the baby we really wanted to make sure it was in.
Right.
There was never, you know, that was the great sort of thing about David, though. There was never like a huge chunk of stuff that I thought was really, you know, important that we didn't get to put in, because he was always like, listen, I'll make it work. You know, don't. I remember he called me up and he said, don't worry about writing a 250-page draft on this
right.
one.
Just it's a very, very generous, you know, you don't feel like anything's missing. And the film feels like it takes its time, you know, and which is so rare nowadays.
No, I mean, you know, and I'm, listen, I'm also one of those people who, you know, I will totally look at my watch, you know, while watching a movie if I don't feel like it's keeping me there. So, you know, I feel like any, you know, if every minute you go over 2 hours, you really have to earn in a feature film. So, you know, I was sort of terrified of doing a movie this long and terrified of, you know, sort of exhausting people and boring people. Because I think there is a lot of, you know, I sort of feel like, you know, in the last 5 years, movies have gotten longer and more self-indulgent in times. And
yeah.
I, you know, didn't want to do that. So, but I think, you know, with a guy like Fincher doing it, you know, at least for me, pacing, you know, isn't an issue in the film, and it keeps you interested, hopefully.
Once you begin to work with Fincher, is obviously he's very collaborative from what you've told me, but does he welcome you on the set? Is it a close collaboration once shooting begins?
It is. I wasn't on the set that much because he's very much of, first of all, set gets very boring. I mean, it's, you know, I was like, I used to, you know, my first movie, I was like, oh, it's going to be so excited, I'll be on set. And then you get to set and, you know, I'd been on sets before, just like visiting and stuff. But, it's either you have absolutely nothing to do as the writer, or you have a lot to do, in which case you're in real trouble, you know,
yeah.
if you're rewriting on set.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a situation I've been in and is not fun either. So, you know, with this, I was there about a third of the time, I would say, and it would just kind of go up. But he, you know, the actors don't, he doesn't run a set where the actors change their lines very much. He does, you know, if they're turning to you and kind of going, can we change this? Can we change that? He doesn't like that. He wants to do the work,
yes.
you know, before you get onto the stage. You
right.
know?
Sure.
The script
sure.
should be locked, and my job should be done, and that's pretty much how it worked out on this. Which was
there's a couple of additional things I want to talk to you about, but your DVD commentary is great.
Oh, good.
In this new package.
I haven't heard it, yeah.
And surprisingly, James Ellroy joins you. How did
yes.
that participation come about?
He was, you know, Ellroy's, and he's one of my heroes. I mean, he's an amazing
sure.
guy, and he and Brad Fisher were working on something, and I had, and he called me up about, you know, and we were just sort of finishing Zodiac, and Fisher called me up and said, do you want to have dinner with James Ellroy? And I said, yeah. and we sort of talked about Zodiac, and then we showed him the movie about a month before it came out, just because, I mean, you know, it's true crime, and it's James Ellroy, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to see the flick? And he really, you know, I don't think I'm overstating it. He flipped out for it. Really was really, really excited, and told us he liked it more than Black Dahlia, which made me really excited. And
a far better film. Oh, got light years ahead of that.
Yeah.
So, and just he really got into it, and you know, was just such a big supporter, and through no, I mean, you know, he got nothing out of this, and so when it came time to do the commentary, you know, I think it's, if James Ellroy wants to do a commentary on your movie, you say yes.
Absolutely. And he really had a firm understanding of what the film was, obviously.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's a brilliant
guy.
He
thought we were going for immediately, which was, you know, really, really cool. You know,
yeah, yeah.
It's nice to get one of your heroes go, you wrote the hell out of this.
That's
yeah,
got to be
that
satisfying,
is.
Yeah. And I'm not lying. I think it's the best screenplay, you know, certainly of this past year.
Oh, thank you very
it's
much.
Stunning work, and I'm
it
sure
is.
That you know award nominations and things. And I needed to ask you about that because obviously you're a writer, and we're in the middle of a writer's strike.
Mm-hmm.
What's the sense you get? What's the morale like among the writers?
Oh, I think the morale is actually pretty good. I mean, I mean, it's sort of compared to what? I mean, nobody's thrilled. Everybody wants to go back to work, but
sure.
it's sort of a situation where I feel like, in a weird way, the studios have made it very easy to be okay with being on strike. You know, nobody's happy with it, but I mean, I haven't talked to anybody who thinks that any of the sort of the offers or anything that's come along is something the Writers Guild should have taken. And
right.
You know, it's some pretty important stuff, you know, I feel that we're on strike for. So I think everybody's bummed and everybody would love to go back to work, but you know, nobody's going, no, let's just take the deal. Come on, it's fine.
Right, right.
So,
does there seem to be any inkling of a promise yet that they will relinquish some of what they're holding on to for dear life?
So I mean, I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, and you know, you can see that there's some, you know, there's some great stuff, you know, online and, you know, different little videos and stuff. But
yeah.
I mean, you know, everybody and their mother knows that you know, the internet is the next, you know, biggest frontier, and everybody knows that there's money that's going to be made off of it, and you know, studios are very, very excited to start doing that, you know, and you know, you can go and watch an episode of The Office for free and have to watch commercials on it on the website, and you know, the guys who created The Office don't get paid for it, and that's messed up.
There's something inherently unfair about that.
And the other thing is too, I mean, you know, and our you know, our town is a small town, it's a small business. I have friends who work at studios and stuff like that, and not one of them really thinks that writers don't deserve a piece of that. You know what I mean? It's just about working at that formula out. So eventually, you know, the world will continue to spin. We'll go back to work. It's just a question of, you know, will it be in time to see that back 8 episodes of Lost or not, you know?
Right. Right.
So, like,
yeah, yeah. In the meantime, you guys are committed to the Writers Guild. They're committed to the SAG Awards, correct? But not the Globes or the Oscars. Is that what's happening on the awards?
I believe so, yeah. And they're committed to the SAG Awards, I believe, chiefly, and I'm not, you know, I'm not involved in the negotiating committees or anything like that.
Right.
Chiefly because SAG has been such a great, you know, strong ally in this. I think it would be kind of a, you know, a dick move to be like, sorry, guys, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. At the same time, you've got, once this writer strike ends, you've got some great upcoming projects, it seems you're attached to.
Yeah, no, I'm very, very excited.
I saw something about, and you can confirm or deny, I saw something about Against All Enemies and Spider-Man 4. Is that true?
Yeah, no, I'm Against All Enemies is actually, it's a script I'm sort of done on it now, but or was, you know, done with it before the strike, but it's Robert Redford's going to direct it. It's an adaptation of
the
Richard
Clarke
book. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard that Sean Penn is in talks for Richard Clarke. Do you know anything about that?
I actually don't. I don't really know where they are sort of on casting. Again, it's sort of, you know, since the strike came down, I'm pretty well out of it.
And Spider-Man 4, I mean, that's quite a behemoth. That's quite a project.
Yeah, that is.
It's gonna be a lot of fun. I went in on that and you know, I really love the films and you know,
what's that phone call like where they're like, how would you like to write Spider-Man 4?
It's pretty much that. I went in and sat in a room with you know, it's sort of an odd process because you are sort of sitting down with you know, people who made the first three and going, well, let me tell you what to do, which is always odd. But I was lucky enough for them to be interested in me, and I'm a huge fan of those movies, and so we sort of closed that up right before the strike. And once the strike's over, I get to go to work. So I'm very
well. I am sure you're going to do wonders with it, and you're an outstanding talent. And please come back to see us, or to talk to us. It's all done by telephone, so obviously talk to us when these future projects come to fruition.
Thank you so much. I'd be delighted to.
Thank you so much,
sir.
We're honored to have you on. Bye bye.
Yes, we are.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. And thanks for supporting the movie. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Bye bye.
All right. Take care, guys. Bye.
That is James Vanderbilt, screenwriter of Zodiac. That was a great thrill because I feel very strongly about Zodiac.
We all do. I think we all did when it came out.
I'll be compiling my top 10 list by the end of the week. I still have like 3-4 titles left to see. One of them being, you know, There Will Be Blood, so there's still a possibility of surprises. But, I mean, even, you know, with No Country, which I'm a fan of, but I'm not in the majority of thinking it's the masterpiece that it is, Zodiac is still probably, I think, the best film of 07.
That would be hard to disagree with. Now, is Lizzie McGuire, is that going to be on your list, or is that last year?
That was last
year.
That was actually 3 years ago.
Oh,
it has
nice, Jamie. Keep up with current events for crying out loud.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The one thing I did, I forgot to ask was, because they started filming in 05, and I don't know, are you all aware of that, of the one studio, the DVD studio that does these quickie true crime?
Yes, they did that.
They did the same people
behind Dahmer and all those other ones.
Dahmer is like the best one of all of them.
Yeah.
Dahmer got actually good reviews.
All of them are pretty, you know, they're pretty horrid outside of Dahmer.
They've done like Bianchi and Bono or whatever, and Hillside Strangler.
Yeah, but they really try to capitalize on it, because there are people, honest to God, because I know this because Chris worked at a video store, I worked at a movie theater, there are people that honestly they'll walk into Blockbuster and Jurassic Park 3 will be out in theaters and they'll see a Roger Corman movie called Carnosaur Island or something. They will think it's the same thing.
Yeah.
They really will.
That's why it works. I mean, that's why it works that way. It comes to their advantage. They're like, or they go see Jurassic Park 3 and like, hey, I want to see something else. They'll get Carnosaur 3.
And so they're like, you know, I don't see what the big deal about the Spielberg guy is.
I understand that. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, in the history of film, it's always been about, you know, quick capitalization on the big hit. So I mean, that goes, you know, it's not Corman or it's nothing new, but have any of y'all watched any of this Zodiac? Which I love how it's called The Zodiac.
Yeah, I like that too.
You know, actually, there's like about 4 or 5 Zodiac films. There's like a TV film.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of. I haven't seen this. I never saw the 05 one. My brother did, because they were airing it on Showtime when the Fincher one came out. And he says the only thing that they have is really, I think, the car, the opening car shooting, and like it turns into a chase film at the end, and it's just kind of all wacky. I will say for that production house, the Dahmer film is pretty good, and if you can stomach it, I've only seen bits of it, but it is well done. The Manson family film.
That's actually got good word of mouth from what I hear.
That's difficult. But if you compare the two Zodiac films, I mean, it's really like comparing a Picasso to a Black Velvet Elvis painting. You know, it's like
there's
no comparison.
I like how it's about 90 minutes, so it's like, you know, even half, it's like half the running time of the Fincher one.
Don't blame them for a short running time on that movie because you don't want to sit through much more.
No, but we're talking about The Zodiac, not Zodiac.
Yeah, The Zodiac.
The Zodiac.
Yeah, it's a big difference there. All right, guys, it's been a great show. Jerry, it's been a great show, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Pat yourself on the back for doing a great job in the chat room.
Thank you. Now, thank all of them. They've all been great.
Absolutely. Everyone in the chat room tonight, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back Wednesday night, another great show where we're going to dissect the Kennedy assassination single-handedly with the director of Oswald's Ghost. And then we're going to turn around and we're going to talk about the music composition for Alvin and the Chipmunks. So I don't know which segment will be more controversial. But
as long
as we get involved.
And then Friday at 1:30, we're part of a press junket to promote Dolph Lundgren's newest movie called Missionary Man.
That's right. You're doing that one, right?
And that happens to be my favorite position. So
thank you so much for...
That'll be a good interview. So until next time, guys, join us Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Please, we enjoy everyone listening out there, and we thank you guys so much. Now we're going to close off with some more of our 70s porn theme music. All right,
30s porn. Okay.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.